My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am with Dr. Christian Cox, who is a professor at Florida International University down in southern Florida. He is an evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and we're going to talk about all these kind of interesting research programs that he's been working on over the years. One of my colleagues and our director of science here at the Orianne Society, Dr. Houston Chandler, has known Christian for a long time, working with him both at Georgia Southern and up at the Mountain Lakes Biological Station in Virginia. And Houston suggested that Christian came on the podcast, and I'm happy he did, because after researching Christian and the work he's been doing and having an initial conversation with him, I'm pretty excited about it. So welcome to the podcast, Christian. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. Well, if you've heard any episodes, you know I like to start at the very beginning. So I want to know how you ended up getting to where you are today. Have you always been into reptiles and amphibians and evolution and ecology, or is this something that hit you like young, or something that hit you later in life? How did that all come about?
Well, I think I was always sort of a nature fanatic. My father is a scientist, and our family likes animals, likes nature. And in high school, I just was a full-on herp nerd. I knew all the scientific names for all the critters. My friend and I would go walk around. I grew up in Iowa, so not renowned for its herp diversity, but there are a lot of snakes up there. And so I would walk around catching snakes or walk around creeks catching crayfish, and did all of that growing up. So I always had a real bent towards nature and animals and understanding nature.
Gotcha. Yeah, and there's a pretty good, in the Midwest and the northern Midwest there, maybe you'd call Iowa Central, but there's a pretty amazing group of herpetologists and field herpers and just people who are generally really focused into snakes and herps and things like that. So I bet it was a nice region to grow up in some ways. So,
but there's not much there's not much of the way of natural areas, but what there is tends to have a lot of animals in them that are growing and reproducing a lot during the short growth season in the summer. So it's a fun place to catch them when it's not covered in snow.
Gotcha. So you grew up in Iowa and always kind of grew up, it sounds like, around nature. And then in high school, you went, full on herp nerd and started looking for things a lot. And then was there a point in time, during that time period, a lot of people wouldn't even recognize that it was a possibility to like work with these animals for a career, but it sounds like you had, a scientist in your family. So maybe you had more of a perspective on that. So as you were looking into going to college and some of that, did you even realize that this was a possibility, or is that kind of what focused you as you looked for colleges?
I honestly didn't. And that's probably partially because my father was a government scientist. But I didn't really know how you could do herpetology as a career at all. But I went to school getting a zoology degree because it was about animals. This was back in the days when you could get a zoology degree. Iowa State was one of the last ones to kind of remove that degree. And so I went to Iowa State University for my undergrad with a zoology degree with the idea that maybe I would be a vet. I didn't really care that much about dogs and cats, but I liked animals. And so I thought maybe that was one path. But I also just thought it was a sort of challenging, in my mind, hard science degree that could work in a variety of different potential careers. And then once I got into college, I got involved with research and I realized that being a scientist was an option and how that works out with being an academic scientist. And so that's really where I gained the understanding of this career.
Gotcha. So you're at Iowa State doing your undergrad. You're getting the endangered zoology degree, and that, as a side note, I've noted that obviously as well, like just how these more, we'll just call them all, you know, species focused ologies, organismal focused ologies have been integrated and dissolved, and it's been kind of sad to me. While a lot of that work still happens, it's just been kind of sad because I think that stuff's very important to biodiversities, obviously what I've built my life around. So just as a side note, that's my soapbox on the loss of zoology degrees. But anyways, so you're at Iowa State and you're doing your undergrad in zoology. Did you realize at a point like, oh, like if I really want to have a career in this, it's unlike some other careers where I'm going to need to go on and get advanced degrees? Or did you try to work in the field first? What happened in that time period?
Well, I was fortunate enough to get involved with the National Science Foundation, what's called a UMEB program. It stands for Undergraduate Mentoring in Environmental Biology. And it was aimed at sort of broadly increasing participation in the sciences. But I got involved with that program, and there was a woman named Eugenia Farrar, who was a professor at Iowa State, and she took me on as a mentor. And we got to, the way I describe the UMEB program is kind of like a group REU or research experience for undergraduates. So we all did research with professor mentors, and she allowed me to develop my own projects, which were mostly like monitoring what kind of critters were at a couple of state managed lands. And then at the same time, I met Fred Jansen, who's a herpetologist at the time at Iowa State. And his wife had just gotten a job there, Dr. Ann Bronikowski. And Ann studied the garter snakes at Eagle Lake, which I can talk about if you're interested. It's a famous system for studying life history evolution. And so I got to go out to California, which was extremely exotic coming from the corn desert of Iowa. I got to go out to California and catch rubber boas and chase garter snakes and stuff like that. So it was at that point that through these interactions with professors, they explained to me how it worked. You need to go to school, get maybe a master's, definitely a PhD, and maybe a postdoc, and you're going to start conducting research. You need to develop these skill sets in order to get a job and become a scientist.
Yeah. And I know, you know, that whole system in California you're talking about fairly well. I've never been there, but so first of all, and I know Ann's work well because my PhD work was focused around life histories, more in kind of like a conservation context, but was focused around life histories. And so her work is cited extensively throughout my dissertation and publications from that. So know her work well. And then my PhD advisor also worked up there, Chuck Peterson from Idaho State University, and he ended up he talked about that actually on a podcast episode we did here. So if anybody wants to hear more about that in depth, you can go check out that episode. But so that's great. So then how did you end up? Did you end up doing the master's and a PhD, or going straight to a PhD? How did you end up in graduate school and all of that? So
I wanted to give myself sort of maximum amount of time to build up my skill sets, and I wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to commit my research program to being, which is how I saw a PhD. So I looked into getting a master's degree first, and I ended up in Stephen Secor's lab at the University of Alabama, where I studied digestive physiology of a bunch of different critters, but mostly Burmese pythons and water snakes. I spent 2 years there. And a big draw was getting to live somewhere in the Southeast and getting to experience the diversity of reptiles and amphibians in the Southeast. So, yeah, spent 2 years studying how digestion works in snakes, which are, you know, have crazy rapid digestion compared to, in crazy ways that digestion changes throughout the feeding cycle compared to most other vertebrates.
Yeah. So you were in Tuscaloosa then?
I was in Tuscaloosa. Beautiful town.
Yeah.
Roll Tide.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but anyways, we don't need to get into football. We can do a whole podcast on that. But anyways, tell us a little bit about, I mean, I'm talking like the high level 30,000 foot, like three bullet points on what you learned about snake digestion and water snakes and pythons.
Sure. So a lot of the previous work in Burmese pythons, this is also work in sidewinders. This was Stephen Secor started this research where he really was the first to show that compared to any of the vertebrates, terrestrial vertebrates that have been studied previously, snakes do crazy things where they'll fast in the case of pythons for a year and they basically turn off their gut. We're talking the stomach acid goes away. They have a neutral pH in their stomach. The villi, which are the little finger-like projections in the small intestine, shrink down to a tiny level. And then when they feed, you get this incredible upregulation of all of the gut. Nutrient transport rates go up. Those are the things that bring amino acids and sugars into the body from the gut. Acid production goes up. The heart gets 50% larger in size. It's just a crazy thing that happens. And almost all snakes that feed really infrequently, like pythons and rattlesnakes, things like that, seem to undergo a similar sort of scope of regulation. And so what organized my master's work was this concept of symorphosis, which I know is a large and maybe confusing sounding word, but the idea of symorphosis is really very simple. It's the idea that systems should be optimized so that the rate at which you break down a carbohydrate, for example, should be about the same rate at which you can bring that carbohydrate into your cells. And so it's this idea that capacities of different organ systems and different steps of a process that happen in an organism should be matched to one another because that should be the most efficient organization. So that was the idea. And the way that we actually did this is I studied digestive enzyme activity. So other work in this system had already looked at nutrient transport rates. So how things like amino acids and sugars get brought into cells. And so what my work did is it brought in the digestive action of enzymes that are acting in the stomach, in the pancreas, and in the small intestine. And then we did this in a species that feeds really infrequently, the Burmese python, which was the workhorse lab model in that lab. And then also in water snakes that we would go collect from catfish farms in Mississippi, bring back, and then study digestion of as well. So that was the theme of the research. And then we put out a number of papers characterizing how you do get these nice matches, these nice functional matches between different parts of digestion.
Huh. Interesting. Little side note. Some of the best snake nights I've ever had have been at fish farms, crayfish farms in Mississippi and Arkansas, where we would literally be able to rack up, no exaggeration, like 200 to 300 water snakes and cottonmouths in a night. I mean, amazing. Anyways, that's a side note.
Yeah. It's insane. There's tons of them.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a fun night. But so just quick question about that like physiological switch that they turn on or whatever you want to call it. Does that happen? Like, are they like, okay, now I'm going to forage and they turn on that switch to like prime the pump, if you will? Or do they forage, eat that rare meal, and then they turn on that switch? Or do we know?
Chris, you have poked a hornet's nest that matters to five people. You poked a hornet's nest of the idea of pay before pumping. So Secor put this idea that snakes, even if they haven't fed for a year, before they start digesting their prey, they're paying for it first. They're paying before pumping, and that they're using endogenous or internal energy reserves that they already have in order to digest the prey. And so they're investing a little bit of their energy first in order to get a bunch of energy in the meal. There's a group of scientists who think that that's definitely not true. And there have been papers back and forth published on this. Secor is no longer active, but there have been papers published back and forth on this and both of them seem to have some evidence in each direction. So my thought is I'm imagining some amount of endogenous energy gets the engine running, but probably it's really important to use that prey, the energy from that current food item in order to fuel that, that response as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Because if that is the case, yeah, there's almost a point of no return where if a snake doesn't like lets itself get below some condition, some body condition, you know, the amount of resources that it has stored within it, that it actually can't effectively digest or feed as efficiently. So it's kind of an interesting idea if it's true. So
yeah, and anecdotally, I think a lot of people who keep snakes have noticed that if they've got a really old snake or a snake that's not in great shape, oftentimes if it does die, it dies after that final meal. And so there may be something about that where it's depleting energy resources. But yes, I think probably they're not initiating any upregulation until they have a food item in their stomach. Right.
Yep.
That would be my guess, is they have to actually feed in order for those pathways to become initiated to upregulate the gut.
Gotcha.
But they still might accidentally regurgitate, you know, if they get bought a predator and then, yeah, they've wasted some of their own internal energy.
Mm-hmm. OK, well, it sounds like you had fun in Alabama. You get to handle a lot of pythons and water snakes. I'd probably rather handle the pythons than the water snakes. But anyway,
they were both terrible, stinky and bit you like crazy.
Yeah. And but probably also got to spend some amazing time in the field. Alabama is one of the just coolest states from a biodiversity perspective in the whole country. Not a lot of people, I think, recognize that. But
oh, I loved Alabama's it. It's a beautiful, amazing state.
And so you ended up doing that. And then how did you end up transitioning to a PhD program?
Yeah, so I was, I knew that while I had this background in physiology and for my undergrad, I got a degree in zoology with a minor in genetics, and I've got kind of a mechanistic molecular bent to the way I tend to think about things. So the digestive physiology satisfied that mechanistic itch. But I thought for a PhD, I wanted to go broad, and I wanted to do something that in my mind was really firmly rooted in evolutionary biology. And to me, that meant population genetics and phylogenetics. And so I reached out to a lot of different people, to varying levels of encouragement, but really what I ended up with was in Paul Chippendale's lab at the University of Texas Arlington. I had a friend and a colleague who was already doing his PhD there. He said I could have a lot of freedom to design my own dissertation, which was really important to me at that point, because I, as a master's student, you don't really have the time frame to completely develop if you want to finish within a couple of years at least. And so that sounded really good to me. So yeah, so I ended up working with two PhD advisors, Paul Chippendale and Jonathan Campbell, for my dissertation at the University of Texas Arlington. And I was asking evolutionary questions and using population genetics and phylogenetics, molecular phylogenetics, in order to answer those questions.
Were there certain animals you were working with in particular? Or?
I was big on snakes then. Still am to a large degree, although the realities of research have had me working on some other critters as well. But I really wanted to stay working with snakes, although Paul Chippendale is a salamander biologist. But I thought there would be a lot of scope to work on snakes in his lab because he had other students that did snake work as well. So I really wanted to stick with snakes for the dissertation.
Gotcha. And was it more of a lab setting or a field setting there in Texas or?
It was both. It was both. I mean, a lot of molecular phylogenetics, but I was working on things that we didn't have a lot of tissue samples available. There weren't already existing tissue collections at the scale that I needed them. There was some stuff, of course. And so, yeah, a lot of field work, a lot of lab work, a lot of analysis.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so that, I'm assuming, laid the groundwork for some of the research programs you work on today. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, certainly started a lot down that path.
Yeah, so we'll get into some of that. So we don't need to go too in depth in the dissertation research, but okay. So you finished the PhD. I already mentioned in the intro. I mentioned Georgia Southern, but I also mentioned that you're, you know, currently professor down at Florida International. So when you finished the PhD, what was kind of the final trajectory in terms of getting where you are today?
Yeah. So for my dissertation, I studied evolution of color polymorphism and mimicry in ground snakes, several species of ground snake. And then for my postdoc, I ended up switching and kind of going back towards physiology, where I worked with Bob Cox at the University of Virginia for 3 years on the evolution of the regulation of sexual dimorphism and growth regulation using gene expression. And I ended up switching sort of directions for a couple of reasons. One of them was pragmatic. You know, that was the only postdoc offer I got. And so that was the one that I took. But also this position gave me an opportunity to get into transcriptomics, which I saw as really linking sort of some of these physiology questions and some of the evolutionary questions that I was interested in asking. So
what is that?
Transcriptomics. Oh, right. Yeah. Transcriptomics is just the study of all of the genes that are expressed in a particular tissue or cell at the same time. This is a new approach. It's only been around the last 20 years or so. And it allows you to, with a lot of power, kind of know what that cell is doing in terms of what kind of mRNAs it is expressing. And so that's a lot of what we do in my lab currently.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, so I want to get after that postdoc, then I went to Georgia Southern for 4 years. And then I ended up moving to Florida International University.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I want to touch on, you know, the sexual dimorphism and the, you know, the color dimorphism type stuff. But I think first I want to start talking about your research program and start talking about a place and then kind of transition into research you've been doing, looking at how reptiles, you know, evolve or deal with kind of extreme environments and changing environments. But let's start and talk about the place. So there's this interesting part of Panama that I have heard a lot about. A lot of it actually comes from like mammal research that I've been looking into relative to one of the species that I'm very interested in, being Bushmasters. And anyways, so talk a little, just set the context for this place you've been working. What is it? Where is it? How is it formed? How is it different than it was? Those types of things.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a quick break and tell you that the Oriane Society is dedicated to protecting some of North America's most at-risk species and their habitats, like eastern indigo snakes in the longleaf savannas, eastern hellbenders in the Appalachian Highlands, and wood turtles in the great northern forests. Healthy ecosystems depend on these incredible animals, but these landscapes and species need our help to survive. If you care about reptiles, amphibians, and the wild places they call home, visit www.orien.org to learn more about our work and how you can get involved.
So a big chunk of our research takes place in the country of Panama, which is right in between Costa Rica and Colombia. So it's the Isthmus of Panama is what connects South America to Central America. And in particular, we study several species of anoles in Panama. And we work in the canal zone of Panama. So this is that part of Central Panama near Panama City where first the French tried, then the Americans managed to build the Panama Canal. And in the context of building the Panama Canal, they built it in the Rio Chagres River Valley. And when they created the dams to make the Panama Canal, which eventually became a lake, the Lake Gatun, and all of the little hilltops that were scattered throughout this Rio Chagres River Valley, all of those hilltops, when they made this giant lake, Lake Gatun, those became islands. And all of those islands, which were once just part of that continuous forest in central Panama, now became little isolated islands. And there's hundreds of them throughout Lake Gatun. And for our purposes, these islands are cool little laboratories of rapid environmental change because they all vary. They're all distinct. They're all different from one another. But especially the small ones tend to be hotter and drier and more variable than the adjacent mainland. And so we can do studies like introduce animals to these islands and then look at how they change throughout the generations on these islands, or watch evolution or other types of change happen.
And is that, you know, the kind of the physical environment you just described, maybe hotter, drier, at least drier on some of these islands, is that different than how they would have been pre-flooding? You know, would those have been more rainforest, cloud forest, whatever it might be type environments?
Yes. Yeah, so the forests in that area are all the sort of natural forest. Nature of the forest there is sort of a gradient of things that are seasonal, tropical forests towards the Pacific side, towards things that are more towards still seasonal, but sort of more like rainforest on the Atlantic side. And so we're not talking very much distance at all. We're talking, you know, a few kilometers, more than a few kilometers, but we're not talking a great amount of distance. So these are a seasonal rainforest. They have a wet monsoon season where if you were there, you would think you're in a tropical rainforest. If you go in the dry season, some of the trees lose their leaves. They're more like a tropical, probably a little more reminiscent of the classic tropical dry forest you get in like the west coast of Mexico or Guanacaste in Costa Rica, something like that. So they're pretty moist much of the year, but then they do have a drier period. So they're not a full-on tropical rainforest.
Okay. And there are, you mentioned lizards. So there are native lizards living there, I'm assuming. What would like the lizard, and you might as well just, while we're kind of just describing the place, I know you're working on lizards, but it'd be interesting to know what snakes survive in that area as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lizard diversity is high, but there's a lot of unevenness. If you were to go and walk along Pipeline Road in Soberana National Forest in Panama, the vast majority of lizards that you would see would be the lizard we work on, because we're smart and we work on the most common lizard. And that's Anolis aplitophallus. Doesn't really have a common name, but we sometimes call it the Panamanian slender anole. It's closely related to some other slender anoles like Anolis lemifrons, which you get more in Costa Rica, et cetera. And those are by far the most common anole, probably 9 out of 10, maybe 19 out of 20 anoles that you see are going to be those slender anoles. There's also a bunch of other anoles that you see there. There's a one that lives on the grass called Anolis aratus. There's one that's big and lives up in the trees called Anolis frenatus. We find there's a water anole there, Anolis pacilipus. There's several other anole species that are there. Lizard-wise, there's amazing diversity. We have the helmeted iguanas, basilisks, both spiny iguanas and green iguanas, skinks, a lot of amoebas, which are sort of like a race runner or a whiptail. So a lot of lizard diversity. Snake diversity is also incredible. You don't tend to see a ton of snakes in the tropics of the Western Hemisphere for whatever reason. A lot of places for them to hide. But we see probably one of the ones we see the most is what they call Equis down there, which is you might call the Fertilance or the Terciopelo. Those are very common. Boa constrictors are also relatively common. We also see a lot of Leptodira or the cat-eyed snakes. We see a lot of imantodes, blunt-headed vine snakes, parrot snakes, Leptophis. And then we get little treats every now and then, a tree boa, Corallis annularis. I was just down there a few weeks ago and we got to see one of those. That was exciting. Or I found some Dipsis, which are snail-eating snakes. And there's a number of racers that you'll see, including some ferocious ones. So we see Chironius down there frequently, which are a forest racer, I think, is the common name. But we also see what are called tiger rat snakes, Spilotes, which are just the most spectacularly aggressive snake I've ever interacted with. They're like a Nerodia on steroids. They do not stop trying to bite you. And yeah, I could go on and on. I'll just list snake species for 10 minutes if you'd like me to. But yeah, so we see a lot of the biodiversity there is incredible, and I love it. That's one of the reasons we like working there.
Sticking with the snakes, I mean, do you think, I mean, it sounds, yeah, I don't think you've been researching this, but what's your gut telling you in terms of like how connected these snake populations are to one another via islands and mainland? Are the snakes on a given island typically pretty isolated, or is there any evidence that the snakes are moving amongst islands or moving amongst, we'll call it the mainland and the islands. What does that look like, or do we know?
I think any large bodied snake that's like a racer or a boa or one of the vipers, the bothrops, those things can just move between islands. It's not a problem at all. They can swim. You know, maybe they get attacked by a peacock bass or a crocodile while they're swimming across the lake. But we're working on a lot of islands that aren't that far from the adjacent mainland. So I think they have no problem moving around there. You get into really small, kind of delicate snakes, more fossorial snakes. Yeah, I bet they're not moving very much between islands. When we see snakes on islands, we see vine snakes like Oxybelis or the Echis, the Bothrops. We'll see things like that on islands. But there could be some of these islands that have sustained small populations. And there are some giant islands like Barro Colorado Island, which is large enough that it has spider monkeys living on it, right? So we're talking, some of these islands are large and probably have nearly the same diversity as the adjacent mainland.
Gotcha. And is the water, given it's associated with the Panama Canal, is it fresh water? Is it salt water? Is it a mix? Like, what's the water like? Just thinking about barrier or facilitating movement of animals.
Yeah, it's mostly fresh. You catch freshwater fish in there, like peacock bass and things like that. But there are fish who have some tolerance for freshwater that are normally saltwater species that you see in there. Things like jack crevalle and snook. And I think people see a shark every now and again swimming through there. And there's manatees in the lake as well. There's a small group of the same manatee species that we have here in Florida that's in there. And then there's a lot of American crocodiles and some spectacled caiman as well.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned this area as like these islands as little laboratories, and you kind of hinted at some of the work with the slender anole, the Panamanian slender anole and moving them and other things. And kind of up front, I prefaced it talking about, you know, a lot of your work in this area is focused on how animals adapt to extreme or changing, in physical environments. And you can reclassify that. but I mean, why don't you just kind of tell us a little bit about how you've taken these laboratories and what you and your lab has been doing to better understand, you know, how animals adapt to change.
We study these Panamanian slender anoles, which I'll have to tell you a little bit about the animal. These are the wimpiest anole you could possibly imagine. They live under the rainforest or forest canopy. They're thermoconformers. They do not shuttle back and forth to regulate their temperature like almost all lizards in North America do. They're like little passive thermometers sitting out in the forest, and they're whatever the temperature is of the air around them. And they're tiny. Males and females are the same size, and they top out at about 2 grams. And they are so wimpy. If you hold them in your hand like this, they start to wilt almost like a salamander or something. You can just see they get a little stressed. And so we have to be very delicate in how we handle them and interact with them. But we're trying to use this species. We are using this species in order to study evolution of the biological response to, or really to study the biological response to rapid environmental change. And that's because these islands, which we focus on small islands. I'll talk more about the islands here in a second. We let these islands act as little laboratories that allow us to assess how climate change, both climate change on the global scale, but also how human land use practices can alter the thermal environment and how a really delicate animal like these Panamanian slender anoles can respond to it. So we use islands that are small. These are all less than a hectare. These are like 2,000 or 3,000 square meters. So they're not very large at all. Probably think on the order of a third or a half acre, something like that. And we catch a number of animals. We measure a bunch of their traits, not just traits related to how they tolerate temperature. We do measure that a lot, but we also measure aspects of their dewlap. So I also use these islands to study color. We look at their parasites, all kinds of things. And then we establish new populations on these islands. Now, these islands we work on are small enough that probably in the in their history, you know, 200 years ago, they would have had slender knolls on them. But they're small enough that probably over time, population cycles, extreme weather events, they've all gone extinct. So most of these islands don't have any anole lizards on them at all. They have basilisks and green iguanas, of course, because those things can swim. And in the case of basilisks, run across water. And they're around the edges. But on the interior of the islands, most of them don't have anoles. Some of them have a different species of anole called Anolis gagei, which we use that as part of our experimental design as well. But yeah, we put these things on islands and then we just visit them year after year. And what's cool about the Panamanian slender anole that I haven't told you about yet is that they are an annual lizard. They basically have a, have an 8-month generation time. And on the mainland, you basically never find any that make it through a full calendar year. They're basically all been replaced by the following year. On the islands occasionally, because probably there's less predation, et cetera. And we're also maybe a little more like occasionally we'll find one that makes it to that second year, but almost never. That's happened only a tiny fraction of time. So basically, these every time we look in a new year, we're looking in a new generation. And if we see shifts in things that are genetically based, then that's evolution. We're looking at change in an allele frequency, essentially, in a population over time. But we're also interested in how individuals you put on these islands can change themselves. So there are ways in which organisms can change their physiology, just like if you're to go to Denver and live in Denver from the sea level where I live in Florida, eventually over time, my body would get better at breathing that air that has less oxygen in it. That's the same thing that animals can do to a degree with regards to temperature. So yeah, we use these islands to study a whole host of questions.
And it seems like this anole, it sounds like they have a pretty wide envelope of temperatures that they can survive in based on the behavior you talked about, them being little thermometers where they're not in and out, or maybe I'm wrong on that. But so it would seem like they're less specialized, say, in thermal environments and would be better adapted to different environments. Do I have that wrong, or is that?
Well, this is an interesting idea. And I think it probably depends on where the animals are thermoconforming. So thermoconforming just means an animal that doesn't thermoregulate. It just sits, it just is the temperature of its environment.
Yep.
Turns out that a thermoregulating lizard frequently maintains its body temperature within a really narrow thermal range. And they're able to do that in a lot of different contexts because they just move between shade and sunlight, maybe altering their posture, et cetera, in order to maintain the body temperature. These lizards that are found in this tropical environment might experience more swings in temperature. And certainly they do at night, right, where they can't, where they're going to be the temperature of whatever their environment is. But we're talking during the wet season, which is when most of these lizards are active and most of them are present. There is very little a variation in temperature. It's 28 degrees, and then the next day it's 28 degrees, and then the next day maybe it's 27.5, and the next day it's 28.5. So they experience very little variation, and they don't have the tool to deal with variation, we don't think. They don't have that shuttling thermoregulation like a skink does or something like that. So previous people have hypothesized that thermoconforming tropical lizards, because they've evolved for millions of years in this really stable thermal environment, might have a harder time coping with a rapid environmental change. And so that was one of the motivations for studying this.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Versus you take like an alligator lizard in wherever, Pacific Northwest, and they actually experience much more variation, you know. Anyways. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned, you've talked about the place and you've talked about the species and the system, you know, that you're working in. How, and you mentioned that you have multiple kind of projects going, looking at that, you know, these animals adapting to change in the environment. Maybe, we don't necessarily need to go through all of them, but are there any examples from that work that you think would be really interesting to describe, or results that you found that are fascinating, just something you could share with our listeners?
Yeah, I'll tell you kind of maybe two or three of the main directions. So the original motivation for the study, so I do all this work with Mike Logan, who's at the University of Nevada, Reno, and with Owen McMillan, who's a staff scientist at STRI, which is the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. It's part of the U.S. federal government that is down in Panama that facilitates scientific research. And so we We originally were motivated to use these islands to study the response to rapid environmental change. And so a lot of our work has been taking lizards from the mainland, measuring aspects of their thermal physiology, such as the maximum temperature that they can tolerate, their metabolism at multiple different temperatures and how it changes with temperature, their thermal preferences. Then we put them on islands and see how they have changed. We also do experiments where we'll take lizards and expose them to warm temperatures and then see how their thermal tolerance changes, and also how their patterns of gene expression, this transcriptomic response, how that changes when they experience warm temperatures. And that's work with Kelly Withrich, who is a PhD student in my lab. So that was the original motivation. And what we found is that, sure enough, they can increase their upper thermal tolerance when you put them on these islands. And a lot of that seems to be driven not by an evolutionary response, but by what's called phenotypic plasticity, which is just within an individual's lifetime, it can tolerate warmer temperatures. But the jury's still out on some of this work. We're still working on those projects. Another direction that we have gone is looking at how parasites change when you put these lizards on islands. We found that when you put them on islands within a generation, and within that first generation, they lose their ectoparasites. So they typically have a lot of mites on them. And because of the life cycle of these mites, where they feed only as juveniles and then drop off and are free living as nymphs and adults, they actually lose those, because probably we're not putting enough mites on the islands with the lizards in order to start a new population of mites on islands that don't have lizards already. On islands with lizards, we actually see that they retain their mites. So we're also looking and seeing what happens with endoparasites, and we've done experiments to see how reducing the amount of parasites that these have, how that affects their thermal tolerances. And we found that when you remove parasites, their upper thermal tolerance goes up. And that's work from my PhD student in my lab, Leah Bakewell. And the real draw for me, because I came in not as a person who studied thermal biology, but is more interested in evolution of color and sexual dimorphism, and was the fact that this species of lizard actually has a polymorphic dewlap. So what polymorphism means is just whenever you have two different color patterns within the same population in the same time. And this species can have either a solid orange dewlap, or it can have a white dewlap with an orange center. And what we've been able to do is put both dewlap types on islands, because the basic predictions of sort of signaling theory are that you should have a signal that maximizes your conspicuousness to things you're trying to signal to. And depending on light level, either the white dewlap with an orange center or the solid colored orange dewlap should be more visible to potential mates or to potential males if they are territorial, that they're trying to fight off, et cetera. And so we've done a lot of work looking at the genetics or genomics of this, and we've actually shown that these dewlap traits actually change depending on where you are in the mainland. In the deeper forest, where you would want a brighter dewlap, we actually see the white, lighter dewlap. And in the part of the forest that's more secondary and more open, you see a solid, more saturated dewlap. So we're then putting on islands to experimentally test these ideas right now.
Huh. Interesting. Well, first I want to go back to the mites, but then we can start talking about color a little bit more. But so with the mites, do you have a hypothesis? Is it just that, so if I heard you right, basically lizard populations with abundant mites or mite populations have a lower thermal tolerance. They can't be as warm. And I may have that wrong, but if that's right, I mean, what's your hypothesis? Just that these parasites, these mites are, you know, providing some level of stress or taking some amount of their energy, so they can't, what's the mechanism there? Do you at least have a hypothesis for it?
Hey everybody, I just wanted to take a break and tell you guys that snakes are one of the most persecuted groups of animals in the world, but we are dedicated to changing that. The Orian Society works every day to ensure there's a future for these amazing animals. If you care about snakes, wildlife or wild places, and you like what you've been hearing on the Snake Talk podcast, support us today by donating on our website at www.orian.org.
Well, Chris, we don't know, but I think you hit the nail on the head with the suggested mechanisms. I think it's probably mediated perhaps through energetics or perhaps through stress pathways, through things like cortisol. I think that's potentially what's controlling it. So we don't know the answer, but that's something we're interested in finding out. But the idea is, if you're using your immune system to fight off parasites, maybe that's less energy that you can use to expressing the genes that allow you to survive or tolerate warmer temperatures.
So, and given these are thermal conformers, or animals that just basically sit in the same place, sun, shade, I mean, how does that play out in nature? So if you have the lizard, say, with a lot of mites, it doesn't have as high of a tolerance, it still sits out in the sun until it dies? Or do they then behaviorally need to go cool down? Or do they just kind of sit there and die? Or do we know?
Well, I suspect sometimes they sit there and die. And I should say that while these are not shuttling thermoregulators, they're not moving around sort of precisely regulating their temperature, they will use a thermal refuge. So when it's really hot, let's say we have 2 or 3 days without rain and it gets really hot down there, it's rare to go a day without rain down in Panama, what you'll find is they're just not out. And so they're probably down in the leaf litter, in little root balls of trees, things like that. They're hiding. They're just not around. So my guess is that, yeah, if you are heavily burned with parasites, the chances that you stay out a little bit too long and you get a little bit too hot and you can't make it back to your refuge is probably a little bit higher.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about color a little bit more. It seems like this is one of the themes that's, you know, kind of thread throughout your career. And so what you mentioned with the anoles in Panama is that, you know, you get these two color morphs with the dewlap, which is what the males use to, you know, signal females, territoriality, various things. But you kind of saw the opposite pattern of what you might predict in terms of what color morph uses which habitats. What you mentioned, you're doing kind of studies going forward on that. Do you have, again, kind of like I asked with the mites, do you have like a hypothesis or a, you know, speculation as to what might be going on with that system, the color habitat relationship?
Well, So that was nicely summarized, and I think the challenge with this research is we don't know precisely what dewlaps are for. It seems obvious. Okay. I mean, anoles will display their dewlap at females, sure, and also at males, and also at me when I'm trying to catch them, and also at a plastic bag that's blowing by in the wind. So we don't really know what they're for. And people who've tried to test this by cutting off dewlaps or gluing a new dewlap on and swapping dewlaps, it's only been done in a couple of species, but the people who've done this have never found any like amazing clear evidence that females are like, I like that dewlap, I'm going to choose that male to mate with. So we don't really know what the dewlap is for. So that complicates things. We did
find that's,
actually.
That's an assumption I was starting with for everything I said is that dewlap does this. But yeah, that's important to stop and consider. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, you're good. So we think of it more generally in terms of a signal. And a signal, regardless of whether it's signaling a predator, I see you, don't come chasing after me, or whether it's signaling a female, I'm good quality, you should come mate with me, or whether it's signaling another male, don't come over here because I'll bite you, it still has to be transmitted clearly through the environment. And we found actually that it does match the predictions of signaling theory, because we found that in dark environments, the lighter dewlap should be the one that's favored. And that's where we find most of the lighter dewlap is in these darker parts of the forest. Okay. And in light environment, the darker, more saturated dewlap should be more, it will be more obvious because it'll stand out against that generally sort of sun saturated light level. And so because of that, that's where we find most of those. So my guess is that the environment does play an important role. I think one of the things I'm interested in is how important cryptic female choice is in this system. So In this system, there's been a lot of work trying to determine, you know, what the dewlap does, and it hasn't found anything satisfying. But there's certainly a possibility that females, after they mate, are then selecting sperm from particular males. And so, so it could be that they're actually selecting based on the dewlap after mating. We know that there is sperm selection, or at least some evidence of sperm selection in some anole species. This is also complicated by the idea that in the literature, some people have referred to this species, although it hasn't been rigorously tested, as socially monogamous. So some people at least have noted that maybe this species, maybe they, once they match up, they're matched up for their short lifespan, in which case maybe the signaling's more about territoriality. So yeah, I'm still completely agnostic on what that signal is for, but I think regardless, it's an interesting way to study how the environment can affect the evolution of signals. And I'm hoping to do some experience so we start to learn what that dewlap is for.
Gotcha. Okay. So sticking on the color for a minute, you know, you mentioned you were working on color going back into your graduate school days. Did you, back when you were doing more work focused on snakes, so have you done any color work with snakes? And if so, could you describe that?
Yeah, I did, and I'm still interested in the evolution of color polymorphism and coral snake mimicry. So we studied the ground snake, Sonora. At the time, it was all considered one species, Sonora semiannulata. We found that it was not even a, all of the populations of this supposed single species weren't even each other's closest relatives. And so this is because, the reason is because they're so variable. So these ground snakes can have either black bands, or they can have a red longitudinal stripe, or they can have both of those traits or neither. And they're also polymorphic for a lot of other traits, such as a black cap, such as a band across their neck. They also vary a lot in the maculation, or the kind of black bit of pigmentation that's in each scale. So they're a super, super variable species. And I was interested in understanding why. Why are they so variable? This is not like most snake species. Many snake species look the same. You know, a diamondback water snake looks basically the same as a juvenile as an adult. It just gets a little duller as it gets larger. So I was really interested in understanding that. And I set out to start to understand that for my PhD. And as a little bit of an aside, when I was just getting ready to do field work, I got an email from a finishing PhD student named Allison Davis at the time. And she was, for her postdoc, she wanted to study ground snakes and was sort of like, let's try to figure out a way to work together. And at first I was super discouraged. I was a brand new PhD student. I was like, well, this other fancier person that's probably got more resources is going to work on this. But I talked to a couple of my mentors, other grad students that were there, and a couple of them were like, well, why don't you just talk to her and see if you guys can figure out a way to work together? And we did, and we worked together. We still work together to this day. And so it's a great example of how a collaboration can really be helpful. Because it turns out this species complex is all over Western North America and down into Mexico. So it really was a big project and required a lot of hands in order to get it done. So my part of the project was really using population genetic tools to try and figure out what kind of selection would be maintaining this kind of variability. And what we found is evidence for sort of what we would call spatially heterogeneous selection. And this just means selection that is sort of going in different strengths and in different directions across the landscape. So a population in Texas might be experiencing different selection pressures than a population in Kansas. And we also found evidence of negative frequency-dependent selection, which is also sometimes called rare morph advantage. And this is just the idea that the rarest morph in a population at any time has the highest fitness, maybe because predators aren't used to seeing it and so don't attack it as quickly, something along those lines. And so using a bunch of techniques that would be a little bit laborious to get into here, that's what we found. We also found some evidence for sort of how old and how stable coral snake mimicry is, but how coral snake mimicry also seems to favor evolution of variation in color polymorphism.
And that's using species in the Southwest, or the mimicry, or were you working across? Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, we work at a lot of different scales. So we worked on the Sonora semiannulata complex, And during that, we discovered there's three different species and one species that's not even closely related to the ground snakes. We also studied the other members of the genus Sonora, including some things that had been removed from Sonora, but we found it needed to be put back into that genus. And then we studied this across all snake species in the Western Hemisphere. And so Allison was sort of the lead on the, and she's Allison Davis Roboski now. She's the lead on all of the work that was more of the phylogenetic broad scale work. And then I focused on the genus Sonora and on within this species group of the ground snake, Sonora simulata.
Okay. How about, excuse me. So we're getting towards an hour, but there's a couple things that I want to just touch on real quick. Talk to me about Tantilla and feeding and skull morphology. Just give us again that 30,000 foot level. You know, first, I guess, tell people what Tantilla is. A lot of people know, but and you know, you can talk about their diet and you know, maybe talk about some of the work there, because what I've read about that, I found that pretty interesting. So,
I'll have to start with an aside, which is saying I know, like, you're a big rattlesnake and viper guy. Mm-hmm. I am a huge fan of tiny little jewel-like snakes. Mm-hmm. I love them. I've always loved them. I think the most excited I've been to find a snake was my first Tantilla, in fact. certainly up there, maybe top five for sure. And so I love these little small snakes. So I've always been fascinated with Sonora, with Tantilla, with some of the other little small group snakes. I work a lot on Diadophis these days as well. Tantilla are a group of small snakes that they top out at maybe a half a meter, and that's a huge one. Most of them are really small. There are three species in the southeastern United States, and there's a bunch more in the central and western United States. And what's interesting about them is that they feed on invertebrates. They have enlarged rear fangs, so they're probably using venom. And most of them actually seem to specialize in feeding on centipedes. And that's a challenge, because centipedes are dangerous, particularly scolopendromorph centipedes. They don't even inject venom with what we would call teeth. They inject venom with their powerful forelimbs, which are called forcipules. So they essentially have poison knives on their hands that they stab either prey or potential predators with. So they're a gnarly critter to try and eat. And yet these slender, tiny little snakes eat centipedes, and some of them seem to really prefer centipedes. So a PhD student in my lab who just finished, by the name of Noah Gripsover, Dr. Noah Gripsover, he was interested in understanding how they feed, because he formerly studied crayfish eating snakes. So he's interested in describing and understanding how snakes feed on things that are hard to feed on. And I've always wanted to work more with Tantilla. And so what we've done there is he's really characterized how different species of Tantilla, as well as Sonora, feed on potentially dangerous prey. Also looked at their prey preferences and other things like that. And he's also built a phylogeny using a ton of data, high throughput genomic methods. He's also built a phylogeny for the group. And we're still in the writing phase, but we're using that to understand the evolution of feeding in these snakes. And then we're using micro CT scans to see how the morphology changes with what items they might be feeding on in this group as well. And so that's been a lot of scanning of museum specimens, a lot of field work to collect live animals for doing the feeding behavior. And in fact, Noah did a little bit of that work on the Orion Preserve, and which was great, because we got what we wanted there, which was Tantilla coronata, and then a lot of molecular work based on tissues that were on loan from different collections, as well as tissues that that we went out and collected ourselves. And I'd kind of collected tissues over the years, so I had a number of tissues from a lot of different species as well. So that's exciting work, and I'm hoping we can come up with some of those papers here soon, because I think it's really interesting. And
you gave a good description, but in general, what did you find? Did the morphology match to diet? Like, what were kind of the just high level? What was the result of the study?
Yeah. So here's some. I'll just try to snap off the most impactful things. One we found is that even the generalist Tantilla, seemed to prefer to eat centipedes in the lab. We found that generalist species tended to have less specialized behaviors when they're feeding, whereas Tantilla coronata, which is more of a centipede specialist, it seems, as well as I think Nigriceps, but I think it was primarily coronata, they had a really specific stereotyped way in which they grab the centipede and then position it and start chewing on it. Their venom also seemed to kill the centipede a lot faster, where the centipede, after getting chewed on for a while, was immobile. And we also found that ground snakes, which are not centipede specialists but will eat them, they use some specialized behaviors in order to kill spiders, where they seem to press the spider down into the substrate and then grab onto them. And then they would sometimes drag the spider, and it looked like they were trying to break off the legs, which probably have minimal nutritional value and maybe, you know, are create issues with swallowing, et cetera. As far as on the phylogeny, what we found and what's going on with morphology at the skeletal level, it seems like there are aspects of the quadrate in the back of the skull that seem to evolve in those really specialist centipede eating snakes. And that probably has something to do with how they're able to leverage and bite those centipedes, which after all have this hard chitinous exoskeleton.
Yep. Okay. Well, there's more research that I wanted to talk about that we didn't get to, but we've been going almost an hour. So for the sake of time, we're going to transition. But before we begin wrapping up, I just wanted to give you the opportunity. You know, we've talked exclusively about your research programs, but you've been in the academic world now. You have various institutions through graduate school, multiple institutions as faculty. Is there anything else you wanted to mention relative to whatever teaching, service, mentoring that's important to you and your lab or anything like that you wanted to discuss before we begin wrapping up?
Well, I'd say one thing I want to do is I want to shout out ringneck snakes, because most of the snake research that I'm doing these days is probably on ringneck snakes. And that's because I teach a field herpetology course at Mountain Lake Biological Station. And there's plenty of garter snakes and water snakes there, but you know, they're too big. So I wanted to find a population of a smaller snake, like a ringneck snake or a worm snake or something. And so we've identified this population of ringneck snakes. And now we've done 5 or 6 projects where we've learned a lot of interesting things with the students on ringneck snakes. So I teach a field herpetology class here at FIU. I also teach a herpetology class at Mountain Lake Biological Station, which is part of the University of Virginia, in the summers when I'm not employed at FIU. And then I taught a herpetology class at Georgia Southern. And for the classes at FIU, we also do independent research with students. And I've been able to do that at Mountain Lake. And so that's been a really rewarding thing, because I don't get to write all the cool papers of what my grad students do, right? That's their job. They write up their dissertation research. But nobody else is going to write these papers on ringneck snakes. So that's something that that's actually a lot of my first authored papers these days are papers on ringneck snakes, which I always enjoy. And we've done a whole host of things on that. And then other than that, yeah, I've worked at both teaching-focused schools and research-focused schools. And all I've learned is that it's all the same job. And they're all great jobs. It's a nice job to have, to get to interact with students and get to teach and also get to do research with them. I've enjoyed it the whole way.
Great. Well, the only thing I would say about all that is that, you know, at Mountain Lake, there are plenty of horridus or timber rattlesnakes. You could be working with the students on those, but if you want to work on ringnecks, that's your call. Anyways.
We get one or two per 3-week field course. We get one or two crotalus, which I do YouTube and show them how to... We do that whole thing.
Gotcha. Okay, great. Well, as you know, I like a good snake story, and I have all my guests tell me one. So what is your best snake story?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I don't know if I could pick a best snake story. There's just so many. I could probably talk on this for 12 hours. But I'll tell you about the story about the snake that I think I was probably the most excited to find and the hardest fought snake ever. So I told you during my dissertation, I studied the Sonora simiunculata species complex. And at the time, historically, there was a subspecies of Sonora that was described from southern Baja California. It was called a Sonora mosari. And we needed some specimens.
What would the common name of that snake be, or that group of snakes in general?
It would just be ground snakes. And I don't, I mean, they had different names, but I don't know if there probably would have been the Baja ground snake or something like that.
Okay, okay.
But these are just little ground snakes. And this Sonora Massari, I told you about this amazing color polymorphism. This species, this population at the time, we just thought of it as a population, just has, they're all brown. They don't have any bands. They don't have any stripes. They're just a little brown snake. Look like a tantilla, except they've got, you know, different head shape than tantilla. So we went down to Baja. Allison Davis-Hrabowski and I went down to Baja for about 2 weeks to try and catch this snake. And we started down a little bit north of Cabo San Lucas. And then we started working our way up the peninsula. And we found all kinds of snakes, but no ground snakes. We found Chyla meniscus and Hypsiglina, and I could go on and on, but we really couldn't find any. And it seemed like everywhere was too dry. So Allison and I went and found there was like a little desert oasis with a spring, and we started flipping rocks around this spring. And after about 2 weeks, I flipped a rock that had what was clearly this population of snakes. And yeah, it was the greatest feeling of relief, because we spent our personal money to go on this trip. And we proved that we could actually find this thing, even in really difficult environment. And then that tissue sample proved critical, because that was the sample that allowed us to realize that this so-called ground snake from southern Baja was not even the closest relative to the snakes that you would get in Texas or Kansas or in California and Arizona. Instead, this snake's closest relative was a species from the west coast of Mexico, which is not too surprising. But it just showed how important it was for us to get that sample. Yeah. So that's probably my favorite experience, was finding that beautiful, albeit drab, little brown ground snake from Baja California.
That's a great story. Well, I think it's important in the world that we have snake people who are into the small brown drab species too. So I'm thankful for you. But anyways, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to thank our audience and tell everybody to remember, snakes are animals too. And it's a privilege to see one in the wild.